Chum den den de jen jawa da jomba yanda wa zobe sanje rigwa da jazo demba dewa jawa jide jebo deve galo jawa lana meba lada menam je tumba sanje chum benya wa jaja doba la jaza lo chudo jazo jawa chum den den de jen Zobe sanje rigba da shabzo denba dewa shiba jiden jemba jebo dewe kalo jirwa lana lada menam jidumba sanje jumden de peja wa shaja tuba la chadze lo Chumden den deje shewa cha chumba yandaba zobe sanje rigwa da shabso denba dewa shewa chikde. Jebo duwe galo yurwa lana meba lada menam je tumba sanje chumden de peja wa shaja. Cha ze lo chudo jazo che ho. Gombo jinzen jambe yala yanze lo kange lo ju chimnye chenje nyenda namda ramse chinye dungge chishe seje nyege doga lewanze ganda zibe zara mare menduma donye geze Chozo gula poje danze yala choje yande son Chodara che jo nyomo nilo lege cha jo cha Marime ze donye nyongo chenye chunze rete na Tene taje saje taze hende lunzo ojase tobe ku Chudra chudra chunyi kente dalu mese jambe yala du Omo arabadzana de Omo arabadzana de Omo arabadzana de Omo arabadzana de di 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 Kera veze ge dalu temu memba ravze Kata denju shonglu tongba hi loje pobe Tse do su Penge juje medo chama reja linshi nyende genba di Sanje shendo mende bwa ye Dugun namda shen che bara choy Tamba ke naman ke chugu kala kenze tente ne Che da zame duja zema la Sabje shuje chava ado su Rana mendala gana daya mea Toye cho namala chanchu bado dane jasu che Tage chushe jibe su namange Jola penje zanje jubara shu Chuda toye cho namala chanchu bado dane jasu che Tage chuje jibe su namange Jola sanje jombara cho Chuda soje cho namala chanjo bardo tane jamsu che Tage chuje jibe su namange Jola jombara cho Lada lame medame anje ombo dan, gyajin lazo choje chola chawa cheba nan, sanje sumba rabdo sheshin tewe gyugyo ba, deda sheje tambe chunye chene deshe she.
Namo Allah ye dan lo dan ne jen ge ju bon da da me ye ge nam dan zho guen ge cha nam che zam tam je ge do da ge zhe dun dos. Good morning. Thank you very much for being very persistent. You all have been coming Sunday after Sunday, and I know that you have gazillion things to do, but still you chose to come here, chose to spend your Sunday morning here. And your this perseverance kind of drives me to prepare my class, even though I don't know that much, but because, you know, after seeing your this commitment, it kind of gives me encouragement and also propels me to do my part. And in the process of doing this, I benefited a lot because I get to read. And then, you know, I learn a lot. So thank you very much. Thank you for, you know, being very persistent with this. So we will do our ritual, the sharing session. So how did you find Langri Thamba's advice when you apply in your life? Any stories to share? Any insights to share? Please. Yes, please.
I have perfected nothing, but I'm working. And I think being aware, just I am much more aware now when I start to self-cherish. I don't always accomplish it. And sometimes even before it goes very far, you know, I can stop myself. And the other is start just to feel sorry for myself. I really, the whole idea of karma, which, you know, I've been involved with for years, but really hitting me now, I can really look back and just kind of laugh and say, well, I chose it, you know, or it's something that is karma. So I think just the awareness has been very helpful because I'm being more aware sooner.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, I believe that the first step to change is to be aware. Remember, I shared with you my own stories when I was in monastery. So I joined monastery earlier. I was in school. You know, all this anger and all this, I have no idea. So when you are kind of thrown in the sea of monks who really practice all this, and then when you show your own that impulsiveness, it becomes so jarring and glaring. It becomes so obvious. Because at school, most are similar to you and you don't really, you know, stand out. But when you are in monastery, it becomes so obvious. And that was the first time I realized that I need to work on my anger. So I felt that was the first step. Since then, I was more careful. But I already warned you that don't test me. Okay, thank you. Anybody? Yes.
Not all that long ago, a few years ago, Abang Rinpoche encouraged us to memorize the 8 verses, recite them. And so I do that at the start of my practice every morning as a reminder to set my motivation properly at the start of the day. And, of course, I quickly forget.
Yeah.
But I've been finding that as time goes on, that doing this every day, things will remind me of the eight verses. And of course, you know, in my own imperfect way, I try to follow them. It's a very difficult practice, and one that's very worthy. But I'm really grateful to have this as a motivation to start my day every day.
Okay, that's good. Thank you. Yeah, this is a common practice in monastery and all that. Yeah, the monks will include that eight verses as their daily prayer. Mm. Yes.
Rinpoche, I'm just, you know, very honored to have you here, because coming Sundays and hearing this also puts me into the right frame of mind. If I didn't have it, I might go on and on, where every week, every Sunday, I go, oh, yes, you know, and then go home and practice. So thank you very much for...
Thank you. Thank you.
Bringing the thoughts
thank
of
you.
Better living and pure...
You see, that's the difference. You are thanking me for nagging you, whereas you will be complaining. Yeah, I think it helps, you know. Even my own experience, one time, I still remember that strongly. In monastery, we have this, every year it's an annual thing that the abbot of the monastery has to give teachings for, not very long, but just for, I think, a week or a 10 days teaching, but on Lamrim teaching. But of course, we have to have the preliminary prayers and then followed by a debate. So the actual teaching is more or less like a half an hour. But I remember that one abbot, he gave teachings on this, the sufferings of our lower realms. And listening to that, I was like, We call this Nyejung Pusu. It's just, you know, I don't know what is the English term. So you really, suddenly you feel that this kind of feeling of this renunciation. But of course, it's not really founded well on this, so it disappears. But for days, it's like, wow, you know, I must practice that kind of, what you call the
motivation.
Yeah, you get that. So yeah, since coming here and I've been nagging you and all this, so I think it will help. So thank you. Mm. Yes.
A few weeks ago, you showed video of people being angry. And I have videos of myself I play. And so I have reminders of don't do that again. But all of a sudden, I find myself saying that every time I think about that.
Mm.
Now, after last week, I say, give the victory to them. And it would have eliminated.
Yeah, yeah.
It would have gone, been gone, just like that.
No, mm,
no reason to be angry. Give the victory to them.
Mm.
Well, that would have been the answer to every one of these things. I never thought about it.
Knew
about it then.
Never too late, isn't it? Yeah. Okay, thank you. Anyone?
I think I thought about the second verse that
you
brought, and I thank you for the discussion we had, because it brought me clarity of the terminology of our perceptions of equanimity and self-cherishing and cherishing others. And I was listening to teachings from Gangkhar Rinpoche, self-cherishing. And it seemed to become clear to me that the bending of the wheat, you know, which I really like, that the bending of the wheat actually is to draw the other person in a mutual way to cherishing others rather than cherishing self.
Mm.
So you said it was like a humbling. It's more about it. Really should be humbling, but the way that it's in English, at least, the way that it's. It creates some difficulties. It has for many years for me, because that was the one that I had this hardest understanding of. But now it seemed like just what you said helped me understand it, not in the sense of what I understand equanimity to be, but that there's different forms of equanimity.
Mm-hmm.
and infinite equanimity is a different. So thank you.
Yeah, I think I understand. Here, you know, I mentioned before, it's all about, you know, you must boost your self-esteem. So when you want to boost your self-esteem, you cannot think of yourself as low, somebody inferior and all that. So this teaching is against that kind of view that, you know, you must always feel that I am the best, I am the supreme or whatever it is. So this is teaching you be humble. Because what happens when, because your goal is to benefit others, to develop this self-cherishing, to cherish others as wish more than wish-fulfilling gem. So when you have this pride and arrogance and conceit, you will never be able to treat others the way the teaching said, to really cherish others. You won't be able to treat that. So that's why this is like a method to deal with that. So this arrogance and this pride, all this comes in between when we try to practice. So as an antidote, what we should do is we should practice this. This the second verse. That's about it. Yeah. Anyone? Yes.
Rinpoche, first of all, thank you very much. This 8 verses, I saw that long time ago. That time I was thought, oh my God, that could be maybe not for us. It must be somebody from different world. From last Sunday, what really helped me is how you can look to the sentient beings. Usually, looks like I'm looking only me and it's like I'm not looking back to sentient being, but I'm not even looking at all. Mm-hmm. So from the way you explain how you have to look the sentient being and Buddha as same. And one of the other examples, your examples are so powerful, it keeps me reminding, you said like a farmer, you want your crops be good and everything. So you have to do good to the sentient being, so your bodhicitta and your enlightenment all depend on the sentient beings. That example really makes me keep thinking, oh really, we have to pay more attention to the sentient beings. That really helped me. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, thank you. Okay, if no more, then let's. You want to say? Okay,
yeah,
please.
It is not completely related to one of the stanza, but I shared my experience this week. One of my coworkers, she was so furious that someone sent an email saying, "What's going on?" So when she was. In the email, it's just mere word, what's going on. But she said, what's going on with this action? So she was telling me, what's going on? I'm so furious. I'm so frustrated. She said this, and she sent the copy to my manager. So I told her, don't take it personally. And then, did you see her saying, doing this? She said, no. So then why you are making it? If you met her and she said, what's going on? The tone must be, what's going on? What's going on? What's going on? These are all levels. So you took the highest level and made yourself disturbed and agitated. So don't take it personally. And in regard to sending copies to your manager, you have the explanation why it has not been done. So manager knows now what. It's not your fault, so it's good, because if that person didn't CC the manager, and if you do not have the ability to explain, then the manager might think that, oh, she didn't do her job, then it will affect your annual review. So it's good that she CC manager, so you didn't look you look at that way, then you will calm down. So she, oh my gosh, I didn't look that way. Thank you. Now I have a smile on my face. She was so this the perspective, the view.
Yeah.
If you look at like what's going on, it's what's going on. It's a mirror. Yes, watch. But then what's going on? And then that's when she said,
yeah.
So I was able to help her to calm down, and she said, oh my gosh, I don't have that attitude. I don't have that practice like you. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So this is the power of interpretation.
Yeah.
Remember how we interpret things, even though it's the same event, but because of how you interpret, three people have different interpretations of one event. Mm. And just, I mean, while listening to your story, it reminded me of a story relating to my godmother. If I have her permission, I wanted to share something. Yeah. My godmother has a very good practice. Is when you receive emails, sometimes you're not very, very hurtful or very angry, you know. emails. And her practice is, she would reply, prepare a reply, but will not send up.
Right.
Will save in the draft box.
Right.
Yeah.
And then next day, she would go back and read it. And then there, oh, this needs to be changed, that needs to be changed. So I thought that was excellent practice. Because when you read that, you are taken over by your emotion, and then you will respond the same way. But if you prepare the reply and leave it for a day, and then when you go back and when you look at it from a different, you know, kind of calm, from that calm state of mind, you will say, oh, this is too much. I better kind of tone it down. So, I personally feel that this is such a good practice. So that's why I'm sharing. I know my mom is not that happy. Okay, so today is our usual meditation session. And we have been doing this mindfulness meditation. And we have been doing two kinds of meditation. One is what is now known as focused attention meditation, where the goal is to really develop this concentration. And the other one is more of observing your sensations and feelings, and you know, without chasing after all this, without making judgment to our emotions and sensations. So what we have been doing so far is strongly influenced by secular version. We have been doing that. Of course, it has its own benefits. But I thought that I should also introduce to you the real traditional practice, the mindfulness practice. There are four mindfulness practices. I think it's translated as, in Tibetan we call it Tenpa Nyesha. But in English term, I think it's called Four Foundations of Mindfulness, and four Foundations of Mindfulness, yeah. So I thought that I'll just briefly introduce these four, mindfulness meditation, and then you can incorporate that in your practice. So these are our last... Oops. Remember this? Okay. So first, the terminology. So nowadays we use this English term. mindfulness. So that was a translation of this term, sati in Pali, and in Sanskrit is called smriti. And in 1850, and Rice David was the person who came up with that term. Of course, there was debate whether that is accurate translation of the term sati or smriti, because sati or smriti has multiple connotations. So it can mean remembrance. This is similar to Tibetan word temba. So remembrance, it can also mean memory, it can also mean reminiscence, it can also mean recollection, it can also mean calling to mind. So because of these varied connotations, there are Buddhist scholars who feel that the term mindfulness is not accurate in capturing the real meaning of sati. So this mindfulness was actually derived from this sutra. There are several of these sutra. Very common one is called Satipatthana Sutra. And also another one was Mahasatipatthana Sutta. These texts are very popular and revered in Sri Lanka and all that. So it is said that most of the Buddhist family would keep a copy of that, and then on special days they will recite the sutra. So this shows that how popular this mindfulness practice in Sri Lanka and the neighboring countries. So the purpose of mindfulness meditation, the real purpose of mindfulness meditation, is not about relaxation, gaining relaxation, not about reducing stress. Remember, nowadays, this MBSR, mindfulness-based stress reduction. From the name itself, you know the purpose is to reduce stress, to have a relaxed mind, to have this calm kind of sensation, state of mind. So that is not the main goal of these sutras. So the main purpose is to gain insight into the nature of the four objects. So later we will discuss the four objects. First, of course, is the body, feelings, mind, and phenomena. So we contemplate on the certain characteristics of these objects. So here, it's much clearer here. So the four foundations of mindfulness. So these are the first, the objects. You have body, feelings, mind, phenomena. So when you do this first meditation, so your object is your body. Has anybody done Vipassana retreat? You have done, yeah. So in this practice, you kind of body scan, do the body scanning. So you go from your either, I'm not very familiar with this, but basically you go step by step, and then you kind of scan your body and observe all these various sensations. So that's the normal practice. But here, when we talk strictly from the Buddhist traditional practice, here what we are trying to do here is, because we have this what is called a flawed perceptions of things, and we, what is that word? Anyway, yeah, we interact with other people based on these three misconceptions, four flawed views or or beliefs or conceptions, whatever you call. So first one is, we hold that body, even though it is impure, from the Buddhist perspective, our body is impure, but we view it as pure, unstained, clean, and then the clinging happens. Then the attachment arises. So here, you have to do this observation, the kind of meditation, contemplation, whereby you try to see the impure, the flaws, or what is called, let me look at that, the fullness of our body, mainly to reduce our attachment. So the goal is to have this understanding that body is unclean in nature, and therefore there is no reason, no point in clinging onto it and this having a strong attachment towards our body. So that's the one part. And then when it comes to feelings, so you observe your feelings. So feelings also, we have these misconceptions that they are pleasurable, they are worth pursuing. From the Buddhist point of view, what is called all contaminated phenomena are unsatisfactory. But we don't view that. We don't see it that way. It's okay. I think it's okay, is it? Oh, yeah, I think. Oh, echo.
The speaker just a tiny bit.
So we don't have that Hello. So we fail to have that understanding, that insight, that feeling all these contaminated feelings are unsatisfactory. So here when we say contaminated, we are saying that all these feelings that are the consequences or results of karma and delusion, these are what is called contaminated. So therefore, there is no way that, you know, in nature it is something pleasurable and long-lasting. But we don't see that way. So that's why we are always in the pursuit of pleasurable feelings. In Four Noble Truths, we know these are three types of sufferings. We can see that suffering of suffering is a suffering, but beyond that, we don't really see that as suffering. But here, that's the one of the purpose here. We are trying to gain this insight that all these various feelings, the pleasant, unpleasant, the neutral, these are all unsatisfactory in nature. And then when it comes to mind, that holding what is momentary as permanent. So even though we know that at the grosser level, that whatever comes out will disappear, whatever will end. When we are born, the end is death. But that's kind of a superficial understanding. But from the Buddhist point of view, it says that all that is produced, all that dujetamjamitava, what the composite phenomena are impermanence. It is always in constant flux, always changing. Even our this class, while I'm talking, it is changing. It is going towards end. Every minute there's a change, but we don't realize that. Because of that, we have difficulty when adversities happen, when things don't last. Because we assumed or we have this expectation that things will last forever, especially relationships. We never expected that to end. Because of that, when this happens, we suffer. So here what we are trying to using the mind, we are trying to gain this insight into the transcendent nature of things, to have this realization that everything is impermanent in nature. And then finally, phenomena. So phenomena, here you can take it as other than these three, can be thoughts, concepts, all these we view. Another, the flawed view is that what lacks as self as having a self. This is about the selflessness. We always have this innate kind of view that there is self from its own side, which is other than, which is separate than our aggregates, our body and mind. When we think I, we always view that there's something absolute, something independent. So here, through the meditation, is to gain this insight into selflessness. So how do we do that in meditation, when we do this breathing meditation observation? Is when we observe our sensations, we will realize that all this, for let's say breathing, one breath, I mean, that this breathing comes, one breath, and then that goes, another breathing starts, that also ends. And then feeling or sensation, you have this sensation, and then that never lasts. It is replaced by another sensation. So when you observe that in a systematic way, slowly all the sensation, and you will have this insight that, oh, my sensations, all this actually changes. It never lasts. And every time a sensation feels, it is replaced by another sensation. So that's how you try to gain the insight into impermanence. And then when you see that all this, when you say, I am feeling happy, I am feeling pain, I feel some numbness, I feel pain here in my mind. When you say I, actually, which is the I? These are all what you call the series of sensations. You feel here some sensation, then you label it as I feel pain. But actually, there is no I from its own side. It is that sensation. So through these repeated observations, one will come to realize that what we call as I and all these are actually series of sensations. And then we cling to all these, even though it is momentarily changes, even though it is transient in nature, we cling onto it. We perceive it as pleasurable, as something to be worth pursuing. That we realize that ends up in suffering. So that's the whole idea of doing this meditation. So when we do this meditation, we are supposed, you can choose any of the topics. You can start with the body. So just to give you an example, this is the excerpt from that sutra. You see, when it meditate on the body parts, in order to reduce our attachment to our body, we have to contemplate on the impurity of our body parts. He says, again, a bhikshu reviews the same body up from the soles of feet and down from top here, and it goes here. In this way, he abides contemplating the body as a body internally, externally, both internally, externally, and he abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. That too is how a bhikshu abides contemplating the body as body. So there are very detailed, I'll just give you some excerpts. this body of mind too is of the same nature as that body, is going to be like that body and has not got past the conditions. So this is to see, when you see a corpse which is full of pus and all that from the decay and all this, to realize that our body will also become the same way in the end. So that's just a kind of glimpse into that, and you can read more, and then yeah, you can do more contemplation, and then I think it will become clearer. So the whole purpose of all this meditation, we have discussed this before, but recently I came across this quote, which is, I think, attributed to Gandhi. Your belief becomes your thought. Your thought becomes your words. Your words become your actions. And your actions become your habits. And your habit becomes your values. And your values become your destiny. By the way, this is... yes, that is Ken... What was that? Kenwood. Cedar Lake. So there is this relationship between our thoughts, our feelings, and our actions. We act upon our thought and belief. Our emotion is, you know, how we respond emotionally is depend on what we believe in. And then we act physically based on our emotion. So here, your belief becomes your thoughts. Your thoughts becomes your words. The more your thought is that way, your words tend to be in that similar direction. So basically, when meditation, the main purpose of meditation, we have discussed this before, bhavana, Tibetan we call it gom, is to familiarize. At the moment, because of our this countless life, familiarizing ourselves in negative actions, it is so easy for us to all these afflictive emotions to arise. Anger, jealousy, all this very easy. We don't need to put effort. It comes effortlessly. Whereas when we need to cultivate the virtue side, it is so difficult. First of all, we don't even remember to do that. Even when we decide to do that, it is so difficult. It is all because that we have not familiarized, we have not accustomed enough. It has not become our habit. Our habit has been engaging in negative actions. So now meditation is to reverse that, to change that. Instead of becoming more familiar with negativities, negative actions, we are trying to familiarize ourselves with the virtuous actions, virtuous thoughts. So if we continuously do that, then that will become our second nature, that will become our habit, and then that will become like this, like the way we can effortlessly produce negative actions. We will be able to produce positive actions without any effort, requiring effort. So of course, mindfulness plays a big role. We may say, oh, okay, it is really good, I want to practice that. But then without mindfulness, first of all, you won't remember. You have to be constantly watching your mind. What is your mind thinking? And then, you know, what is your other doors, speech and body, what are they doing? So constantly watch that. So all this through practice, through doing meditation helps. So that's a short introduction, and then we can do the meditation. Let's begin the practice by finding a relaxed, comfortable posture. Your spine should be straight like an arrow. Hold your head slightly bent forward, not too high. Shoulders should be level and relaxed, neither slouching nor stiff and tense. Place your two hands in the meditation gesture, the right hand on top of the left hand, with your thumbs touching at about the level of the navel. Alternatively, you could place your hands gently on your thighs with the tips of your fingers resting on your knees. Let your mouth and teeth rest in a relaxed, natural position. The tip of your tongue should rest gently on the upper palate, just behind the teeth. Let your eyes relax. You can either keep them gently closed or gaze softly in front of you at an angle where, if you were to look, you would see the tip of your nose. Let's take three deep breaths. Each time, breathing all the way down into your belly as if you are filling up the torso with the in-breath from the bottom to the top. Breathe deeply in this way, one breath at a time, and feel your belly rising each time as the air fills in. When you exhale, let your breath out at a slow, measured pace. Again, draw in a deep breath, filling your body with revitalizing oxygen. And as you slowly release this second breath, feel yourself relaxing. On the final deep breath, draw in all of your attention into this moment and release the breath slowly, feeling yourself drop into your body and into the present moment. Now bring your attention to the present moment by focusing on your breath. Choose a pace of breathing that is neither shallow nor deep, just natural. Now choose a focal point to help anchor your awareness of the sensation of your breathing. Notice where you feel your breath in your body most prominently. It could be the tips of your nostrils where you feel subtle sensations as you breathe in and out, or your belly where you feel the sensation of its rising and falling as you breathe. Once you have the focal point, just breathe in and out while resting your mind on that focal point. There is no need to think about your breath, nor control it. Simply allow your body to breathe naturally at its own pace and experience each incoming and outgoing breath. As you do this, you might notice that your mind has wandered. You may start thinking about other things. If this happens, it is not a problem. It's very natural. Simply notice that your mind has wandered and gently bring it back to your breath. It is important not to judge yourself when this happens. Simply bring your attention back to your breath and continue focusing on it. If you are finding it difficult to hold your attention on your breath, you can try counting. You can try mentally counting your breath with each round of an inhalation and exhalation as one cycle. Breathe in. As you breathe out, mentally say one. You could count up to 10 and then start over. Now let's shift our awareness from the breath to our unfolding inner experiences. Allow any thoughts, emotions, or sensations in the space of your mind arise naturally, and simply be aware of their presence. Allow them to arise, to be there, and then pass on in their natural course. Do not show preference for one kind of thought or feeling over another. Do not try to resist certain kinds of thoughts or feelings, and try not to get involved in these thoughts or feelings. Simply allow them to emerge in the space of your mind. Observe them while they are there, then allow them to pass naturally. So this is where we apply the four mindfulness practices, where we observe all the sensations come and go, and to gain insight into how our emotions and sensations are transient in their nature. And also when we feel these sensations and feelings, how we label them as I am feeling this and that feeling, even though it is a series of these sensations. can slowly come out of your meditation. And you may take 3 deep breaths. Okay. We are way past our break. Let's have this tea break and then we can discuss. So what shall we do now? Yeah, I think let's have some discussion. I think the meditation was a bit long. So let's have a discussion. So how was it? How was the meditation for you?
Great.
Mm.
Too long for me.
Mm. Yeah, it was a bit long because I wanted to start with the focus attention and then wanted to give more time on the second part. And then I also have to, there is this break thing which I have to take into account. Tea break. Yeah. Maybe next time we can do something like first part, we will just focus on focus attention meditation. And then, yeah.
It's fine. Don't worry about it.
Yeah. Normally, of course, these meditations, the advice is to do short sessions. Mm-hmm. More sessions, but short ones. You begin with the short sessions first. But we normally do the opposite, especially when we're doing retreat. Oh, we begin with, you know, the session start with 3 hours, we can, and then it becomes shorter and shorter and shorter. But it is actually the other way around. Mm. Yeah. What else? Anybody want to share about your experience?
My experience was, usually I do prayers when I thought my mind is in the prayer.
Mm-hmm.
So today I was just following the Rinpoche and so now when I go to breathing and then I go to number, then I feel like then if there's no number, what I'm supposed to think? And then I become so like a little bit later, I feel like my whole body is so tight. And then I'm like, you know, what I'm supposed to think? Usually I put my prayers, then my mind goes to the prayer. And today, then I bring to the breathing. Then after a while, and then what I'm supposed to think when there's
yeah.
the number.
So there are two parts to this meditation. The first one is we are trying to cultivate concentration. We're trying to improve our degree of concentration. So that can be achieved only by resting our mind on a particular object. So in this case, we are using our breathing as the object of focus. So you don't need to think anything. If you think about things, then you will get distracted. So you just have to focus on your breathing. So that's why it's a first find a focal point. So she said you can use your nostrils. When you're breathing in, out, sometimes you feel sensation here. But if you don't feel it here, you can use your belly. There's this rising up and down. Rising and falling of your belly here. So, yeah, I find focusing on belly easier. Because sometimes, some days you feel the sensation at your nostrils, but sometimes you don't feel it. But here, the sensation of rising and falling is always there. So the main purpose here, main goal is not to let your mind wander. So when you are doing this, you may be thinking something else. That means your mind is already distracted. Your mind is not on your breathing. Your mind is already after that thought. So when you, the important thing is to realize that, oh, my mind has wandered. Okay, bring it back. Bring it back. For the beginners, first time when you try to do that, you may not be even able to rest your mind or focus your mind on the object for even 30 seconds. You try to do that, minute is already somewhere else. Bring back, bring back. So through persistence, then there will come a time, oh, I can focus more and more. So that's why the technique counting is suggested. Because you count, you say, you observe your mind, one, you breathe in, breathe out, one, two, but then you will see that after at three, your mind already is somewhere else. Again, restart. Again, okay, let me start again. One, two, three, four. Maybe at five, your mind is back. So you bring back, and then you will come to a time where, oh, I can do 10 easily without my mind get distracted. And then you can continue doing that. And then there will come a time where you don't even need that counting. You can just place your mind on the object and you will be able to remain as long as you wish. So that's the first part. Second part is where we need the contemplation. So you observe your feelings, sensations, and then you notice, oh, you are making this kind of conclusion. Oh, it comes and goes. It never remains static. So this is impermanent. There is no permanent thing because it, even my breath, my sensation, all this. So this is the meditation. But application is that sometimes when we are challenged with difficulties, pain, suffering, we kind of go into depression thinking that, oh, I'm suffering, there's no escape. But when you think of these as impermanence, these are also dependent on cause and condition. It doesn't have its own kind of freedom or independence. It is fully contingent on cause and conditions. The moment cause and condition changes, it has to change. It doesn't have its own freedom. So when you realize that, oh, suffering is also same. I am now suffering, having this difficulty, but like every other things, it will also change. So then you don't feel that kind of, what do you call, overwhelmed by your problems. That's the application part. Yeah?
So I have a question. When you take deep breath three times, then go to the normal breathing, in which case normal breathing, we don't...
Yeah, you don't have to do. No, you don't have to do that. But you see, when you... Even you just try to, it depends, maybe it depends on individual. Yeah, some people, yeah, you can feel the rising and falling. Even though you are not doing this deep breathing, you can still feel. So that I think maybe, yeah, when you become more sensitive to your sensations, then yeah, maybe you will be able to. But the point is to find a focal point, whichever is, what do you call, more effective to you, more announced to you, that you find it easier to focus on that. You just need to find. So that's why traditional practice, we use Buddha's image. Instead of focusing on breathing and all this, we use an image. We kind of visualize the Buddha's body and then try to remain on. That is very tough compared to, you know, focusing on your breathing. So maybe the gradual... Maybe the way is to first try on your breathing, and then maybe you can progress to the Buddha's image. But it all depends on, you know, individual. Some people may find it easier to use Buddha's image, but may others may find it easier to use breathing. So it's up to individual. But main goal is to be able to remain your mind on that object. That's the main goal.
So
So the point is that you have to find an object.
Object.
Anywhere. It's not about mind, not thinking anything.
Not thinking at the moment. Not thinking means not blanking out. Yeah, that also we have to. Yeah, you have to. You have to focus on. Let's say if you are, you can even use this kind of, this object, and you just kind of visualize this, and then just focus your mind there. When it goes, it gets distracted. Bring back. But there's danger. Some people misunderstand as spacing out. That means you don't think at all. Just go blank. Or that's not the way. That's not the way. Because when you are focusing on your breathing, your mind is not blank. You are still, you know, it's alert. Mind is alert. And at the back of your mind, there is this awareness at work. It's watching whether your mind is focusing on that object or not. It is all the time watching. When we lose that awareness, then, of course, you don't even realize when your mind wanders.
That may be a red time blindness that I don't even realize my mind is lost.
Yeah, if you don't have that awareness, then you don't realize, you won't even realize that your mind has wandered. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. A couple observations for me. The first is that I know that my mind is very intent on keeping track of things. So counting breaths, you know, what I'm really focusing on is what's the count now, rather than the breath. And so, okay, another breath, count just increased by one or, you know, to two. So really, you know, I have some attention on the breathing, but really a lot of what my mind is occupying itself with is remembering what the count is, paying attention to that. So it's not quite the same focus, it's really someplace else. So it ends up, for me at least, I really want to try to focus on the breathing, to pay attention to the breathing and not the count, because I can keep count for a long time, and that really just sort of being spaced out while the breathing's going on. The other thing is that sometimes when I'm relaxed, my breathing can get really slow. And so sometimes what I'm really noticing is that I'm really not breathing at all. You know, I'm just, you know, usually it's on the exhalation. I'm just, you know, there's nothing happening. Sometimes there's a pause on the inhalation. I can pay attention to these things, but really what I'm noticing is I'm not really breathing right now. So it can be a little disconcerting.
Yeah, I think as long as your mind is there, it is good enough, good sign. Because you are obviously constantly aware of your mind, where it is and how you are feeling. So that serves the purpose. For many of us, it's like, focus, close your eyes there, and then already something else pops in your mind. Then have to bring back.
Is that maybe I'm pushing too hard? Is that my body is kind of, that I found out, kind of tired? He's more relaxed, getting don't feel the breathing. I'm too tidying myself.
Yeah, so I think you are trying to, I'm not doing this, I'm not doing right, I'm doing not doing the right way. So there's a lot of concern there. So you're just free of those concerns. You just try to keep the mind on that whatever object you chose. Yes?
For me, the Rinpoche told me about counting it, counting up to 10. It keeps me, my mind keeps in the same level and not going anywhere.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, so whatever helps, we should employ. Yeah, for some people, doing mantra helps to focus. They will just say, Om Mani Padme, Om Mani Padme, Om Mani. They will keep their mind on the mantra itself, Om Mani Padme, Om Mani Padme. But normal, our practice is Om Mani Padme, our mind is all over India, all this touring the world. And then we wonder, did I finish one mala or not? So that shows that, we are not, focusing. So when you can use mantra to also develop this concentration.
I went into the, you know, the body, and that went too quickly, and then the feelings, and then I went into a very difficult feeling, because this week in the last few weeks, I've been emptying, you know, my attic, and I've been in my house for decades, and so I'm finding things of just the symbols of great loss. And so I was upset about that because I hadn't seen that and so forth. And then I realized, because I'd done the aggregate and so forth, I realized that, you know, it's I'm too attached to that, because it's like, I can't put it into words, but it has something to do with, you know, with the selflessness and so forth. Those are the aggregates, you know. It's, can look at this, but it's also, it came at the time when it was a great difficult time, but soon after that, it was only a few years later that you know, 9/11 came, and then the year later came and Giotto did a ceremony at Mall of America, and that's when I first encountered Giotto, and just, you know, then the teachings came, and it's like what came before, great time of loss, but it's almost like scorched hurt, you know. It's like sometimes, you know, the feels needs to be burnt, and to prepare the soil for a better place, and it's like that's what came. So so I'm gonna take all these boxes and boxes and keep it for right now. Some of it is I can let go, but the ones that I'm not quite ready yet, I'm going to put it in my meditation room for a while, you know, and just kind of continue this, this kind of thing. But it's like the impermanence. Yeah, it's like it was just a few years that the deliverance came, you know, that the teachings, you know, that I needed, and it just came, you know, and that just made my life a totally different, you know.
That's good.
Kind of different experience, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I experienced this almost like a, I don't know if it's a flashback, but all your experiences that you've ever typed, the time of just being, it kind of stays with you. It's just like it's some kind of, sort of like a reminder, the mindfulness of that, you know, whatever that is with those experiences. And when you go back, it's just, it's so comfortable. It's just a place, like you're going home, or you're going to a place where you feel everything is okay, or, you know, when I first took first training I did in breathing at Shambhala, they said concentrate on just the out-breath, just leave your mind there. And that seemed to help in the beginning. But then after that, I just decided to meditate without any instructions, without any, just try to do it from just being, you know, just being. And then later you start learning and you start training more, because you learn more, and then it keeps refining, and you think you've gotten somewhere, and then you realize you read something, and it's just like, oh, you know, I've been doing this, you know, but no, it's actually this way, you know. So for those who are taking their own steps, you know, it's sometimes it's easier to take the steps than someone who has walked before you.
Yeah, I think that's why our tradition is always have a guru. Because first of all, to having a guru is that guru, I'm not talking about me, you know, just great gurus, you know, they practice and they have this experiential insight. And they have also received blessings and instructions from their own guru, which goes on and on. There's this pure lineage there. So there is a difference. Yes, you may learn a lot of things by yourself. Read all the books available nowadays. There are so many books available. But Jeff, what do you call practicing under a guidance of a qualified guru makes a big difference. Yeah. So that is important. So sometimes, yeah, you think that, oh, you got it, everything, and then, you know, you spend so many years and realize that, oh, all I'm doing is wrong. Then what a waste. So it is important to, you know, follow or what you call rely on a qualified teacher. Yeah, and then, of course, you can read all this, but you need to have kind of a, I always feel that you need to, that's why I always advise people, use Lamrim as your main thing, that as your guide. Then you can bring other things, you can refer to other books, but anything that differs from Lamrim, then you have to be careful. Even though it really suits you, you know, but then you have to be careful. You have to examine and analyze that. Where is this coming? How is it? Yeah, sometimes, yeah, we are so excited by all this. Nowadays, there are so many scholars who write these books and then come up with these modern terms, which mainly to suit people. It's not really whether it is, what do you call, accordance with the teaching or not, but they will try to explain to suit your culture and all this. It may suit your culture, but it may be different from the actual teaching. So that we have to be very careful. You read this, oh, this is so good, you know, I like it, all this thing, but they may not be the actual. So that's why there's a lot of noise from this secularization. Many people say that this is, you know, really diluting the Buddha's teaching. You are only taking, you know, you have this 100 person there, you're taking only 10 person and making it the big deal. This is the, what is that word, quintessential? The main, that's the only thing, you know. Yeah, so that's why it's very careful. I think Anthony raised a good point that, you know, it is important to rely on qualified teacher. I mean, I am emphasizing on that. Okay. Anything else?
You know, I was listening to one of my teachers that I met at Naropa, and he's a Western teacher. And he's had lots of, you know, teachers, obviously. And so he's a... I was listening to one of his recordings, and he was using a very, very exact thing you said. He was using the cultural... indoctrination of words and terminologies that suited people to so that it would reach a wider audience rather than those that technically say, you know, there's no soul. Like he would use the word soul, but then he would explain, I don't mean soul in the way that you may think that I mean it. It's something like that. But I kind of interesting because is it worthy to, you know, to get a wider, you know, is it okay to do that if you're getting more people turned in and turned on to the Dharma? Or is it better to just you know, speak from Sanskrit or from whatever tradition?
Yeah, I think there is debate. Of course, debate. You want to, you know, dilute everything to, you know, have more people, but then in the end, the question is, does it really, whatever they're doing, are they really doing Dharma practice or not?
Yeah.
If they are doing Dharma practice, why not? Yeah. So it all, I think, boils down to whether there's a real Dharma practice or not. Any views on this point? Want to share your views?
I'm certainly not really steeped in the tradition, the Western teaching about mindfulness-based stress reduction, that kind of thing. But that's a case where I think you could argue that really not fully teaching Dharma, and yet it is useful.
Yeah.
It's very helpful for people. And so I don't think that that's a waste of time and effort. I think it is helpful for people. So I think there's times where you can borrow pieces of the Buddha's teachings, and they are a benefit to people, and that's a good thing. I think you just have to be careful about what you call it.
Yes. Yes.
Not really Dharma, but still it helps people, and so that's good.
Yep, I agree with you. During the Mind and Life conference, I actually raised that issue. I said that, these are good to help, but don't make it as it is the only teaching. Don't make it like this is the quintessential, you know, Buddhist, this is the main teaching. It is not. It is derived from Buddhist practice, but that is not the whole thing. Some people make that as the whole thing. That is the main Buddhist practice. That is not. I have... complain against those who claim that as the quintessential teaching or practice of Buddhism.
Well, there's also and the culture. Every religion. I don't know if it's every religion, but for instance, like Christianity, like in South America, let's say Catholicism, they'll have the Black Virgin. They'll have this. They'll have that. And in Buddhism, you have like in Thich Nhat Hanh, and in Vietnam, there's the altars for the elders and so on. So there is some cultural pieces. And I know, like, for instance, like there's some Tibetan things that in my mind, you know, Tibetan Buddhism, but in my mind, they are cultural. I can't think of naming one, but there is some of that. And so therefore, because I look at it that way, that global way, I kind of say, I'm able to say, well, you don't have to do this part because this is the culture, and you're not from that, then you don't have to do this particular part. One of the things, for instance, it's like a simple thing, it's like when I read like Sanskrit or some of the mantra, I don't pronounce it like you guys do. I pronounce it like this. It's a Sanskrit. I pronounce it like a Sanskrit. My French-trained tongue can say it better that way in your Sanskrit because, you know, French is Indo-European language. So it's like, you know, people would say, Vajrasattva, instead of saying Vajrasattva, they'll see someone, you know, with the, you guys have trouble with the B and the V's, you know, this, right? I've noticed that because I pay attention to that. So there's some things, you know, what is quintessential Buddhism? Well, it's the Dhamrim. And the rest of it in some of the monasteries, different countries and so forth, they will have different things that are cultural. And so but it's like that with other religions as well. So that's kind of part of what we're talking about. It's like, for instance, we were talking earlier about, you know, self-cherishing. Well, in our country, there's a pretty high rate of suicide. Yeah, you can whittle it down to self-cherishing, but it's also, it's a sense that the person doesn't feel, you know, that they have anything to contribute at all, and so there's a problem for Westerners to try to discuss this concept. The same thing as everyone is my mother. As you know, you've come across time and time again. Yeah, people, individuals say, well, my mother was not like that at all, and then we have to say, well, you know, look at your gurus or your this or your that and so on, you know, but the essential, the quintessential is about, you know, it's more about your mother. And so there's some ways, and it's only qualified gurus who will know how to, you know, and with knowledge of the culture where they're embedded in temporarily, that will make it, you know, authentic. So that's my thought.
Okay, thank you. I think I have a bit different view than yours. I think that the Tibetan culture is actually influenced by Buddhist philosophy or Buddhist view. It's not the other way around. is, you know, what we do, the Buddhist practice, is influenced by Tibetan culture. I feel there is other way around. That's why all these Tibetan practices and Tibetan culture, there's a lot of Dharma in there.
Yeah.
It's influenced by Dharma. Because King Songzhen
Gampo,
when he introduced all this from Dhammapada,
So
I don't know whether I understood correctly or not. I thought that your view is that Tibetan Buddhism is influenced by Tibetan culture. But I think that it's the other way around.
Yeah, that's not, if I said that I misspoke. No, I know how deeply embedded, but I can't think of any little thing. But some of little things, you know, like food or this or that, it doesn't necessarily, you know, be part of it.
Definitely there is, there may be some which are influenced by culture itself.
Yeah.
But mainly, I think Tibetan culture is influenced by Buddhism. Yeah, there's a lot of cultures that is actually from the Buddhists. Mm. Any more? Please.
Now we're on that topic of culture. I mean, the Chinese are notorious for, changing practices, religious practices, according to suit their own culture.
Mm-hmm.
But having said that, I think when we don't want to do something in Dharma, which comes from the Dharma, so to speak, there's a tendency to say, oh, it's just culture, so I don't need to do it.
Mm.
I think before we can do that, we have to be sure as to what is the source of our belief that this is just cultural.
Mm.
Guru devotion is the example.
Mm.
Coming from the East, I find it quite comfortable to be respectful to the teacher. But I go to this course in Kopan Monastery. I went for 10 years in a row.
Mm.
And every year is about 250 people from all over the world. And what I found very interesting is that guru devotion is so difficult for Westerners.
Mm.
They feel somehow they're being asked to be servile, to be like a servant.
Mm.
And that this has nothing to do with me. So why should I value the guru? It's just guru. It's just... You know, what makes him better than me is he's just got a uniform, you know. there's this kind of view. So, and yet it's such a waste because as we can see from the translated texts and teachings the lamas give us, the guru devotion is actually, you know, really the root and it appears in so many of the sutras. So if we are just going to wave it off and say, oh, that's just cultural practice, what a shame. And then we lose the root.
Mm-hmm.
So I think before we can... disregard something as cultural, we need to do a bit of homework to see whether it's really cultural or whether it's actually taught by the Buddha.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you very much for sharing. And it's already time. Time is up. We do our concluding prayers.
Our concluding prayers with the Shrimad Bhagavatam offering. And then continue on page 6 with the rest of the concluding prayers.
Medo tamare ra linje nyende genpa de sanje shen la miden bewaay Rukwe namda jen la jebara jo Rana menda la gana ya daya me Rimbo je ma je ba nam je gyur je je ba nyam ba me ba ya kone kondo pe wara sho ko je rab den je nam gara je le jo jo je wa da lo zan den be dwe me sa zo mo je dro be me se ta to ne gyur je Korve shengamde pendan dewa malu chungwe ne Chere sewan tenzin jazo ye Shabe sete bado ten gyoro je Jedara jemba dan gondo sambo deyan dejendo Deda gungi jezo dalo je Gewa deda damje rabdo ongo Yawa damje ji ngowa kala chodo ngawa Daji gewe cawa ndigwe jang Sambu chuji rabdo ngowara ji